All right. Okay. So, hey, how's it going?
Well, how are you?
Pretty good. Confinement's done, so
Wait, it's done, done?
done.
Or
Done. Done. It's like no, I mean like confinement is relaxed, let's say. Like you don't need justification to every time you go outside anymore. Which
formally, or is it like informally? Like, so I noticed here in New Jersey on Mother's Day, there were so many cars, people out, and like you could. It felt that life was kind of back to normal, with the exception that everyone was wearing masks.
That's kind of like what it is here. So like up until Monday, every time you went outside, you needed to have the certificate. You needed to have a self-signed certificate that attested why you were going out. And now you
Here in
don't.
New Jersey, it never got to that level where
Okay.
it was always a sort of a recommendation to stay at
Right.
home, but there
Yeah.
was no sort of legal.
So now we're kind of in that state, although there are still some legal restrictions. Like, for example, that certificate is now required if you go more than 100 kilometers from your home, or if you go outside of your like your region. So for example, if I wanted to go to like the south of France or something like that, I wouldn't be able to do that unless I had some like good reason to do so, like work related or like some family reason or something like that. Like I couldn't just go on vacation right now.
Where do you get the certificate from? Like, how much of a bureaucratic process is
It's
that?
just like a thing that you sign. Like you have to self-sign, and it's like under oath, basically.
I see.
I mean that's how it was all the entire time, and it's more of a thing where, it's one, it's like a burden. Like every time you go outside, you have to like print this out and like fill it in. And then also it like allows the the police or whoever's checking you to. To like verify that you're out for a good reason. If they deem that it's not a good reason, they could fine you. So now with this new rule where you can't go more than 100 kilometers, like I haven't looked because I don't have a need to go more than 100 kilometers, but I think it's probably something like, you check off like work related reason, or like I need to say you're, you have kids and you're divorced and you need to bring your kids to your spouse, or if you need to take care of a loved one who's like elderly or that kind of thing. Then you would be able to do so, but you'd need to have some kind of justification. Like you'd need to have a document from your boss or something like that,
And this is a French specific thing.
this is France specific. I think like Italy, I mean France basically modeled their quarantine on Italy, so I think Italy was doing similar. Germany is much more lax, so like my girlfriend, she's from Germany, she's here right now, but in Germany like a month ago when we were there was no confinement, but people were wearing masks. So now that's kind of like how it is now here. People are still going outside, but they're wearing masks. If you're going to a supermarket, you're wearing a mask. If you're in if you take any form of public transit, like you wearing a mask is mandatory, otherwise you can get fined.
Yeah, I haven't been back in New York in a little, since like maybe beginning of March, so I'm not sure how it what it's like in American cities, to be honest. But the suburbs, yeah, things seem largely back to normal, with the exception of everyone's wearing masks.
Yeah, I mean it's kind of the same here, like out in the suburbs, it's a little bit less of a burden, I guess. Like, I was talking with friends who live like in Paris in the city during confinement, and like yeah, it was tough. Like for starters, like if let's say you're in a relationship or something and like your partner lives on the other side of town, well you wouldn't be able to see that person on, or like face a fine or something like that. But also just if you're in a small apartment and you can't really go outside and the parks are closed and like you're kind of confined to your neighborhood, that can be hard. Like I'm lucky where I live, it's somewhat a little bit more spacious. There's like woods nearby. So I was like quite fortunate, I think.
So this has nothing to do with COVID, but while we were on the topic of comparing American cities to French cities
Sure.
or European cities, I just randomly remembered that the time, like, I think it was last year when we were all in Berlin and you were staying in an Airbnb and you couldn't get into your Airbnb because your street was closed because there was a bomb.
Oh, like, yes.
Like, what was it? Like, just like a 2-ton bomb from.
No, so that wasn't, me actually. It was friends of mine. It was my friends with whom I came to the meetup or to the ICF conference. And so they were staying in an apartment next to Alexanderplatz in Berlin. And we were going to go back and like hang out on the roof of their building. And as we're getting closer to their building, there's like police and, you know, kind of like do not cross lines everywhere. And then we get to the building and they're like, yeah, we found a World War II bomb like in this construction site next to it. And so the entire neighborhood has been evacuated.
And that was just mind-blowing to me. And then I think it was you and some other people who I know who also live in Europe. They said that, yeah, you know, their reaction was like, yeah, this kind of thing happens every like 2 or 3 years. You know,
yeah, I think in Germany it happens reasonably often, yeah.
And I was just mind-blown because I, you know, having lived in the United States or like, you know, in Canada, is like that was just a mind-boggling thing to me that like it never occurred to me that that was like something that happens, that there's just like a 60-year-old bomb just like sitting underneath like your city.
Well, very much to that same kind of reaction. The funny thing was like they called Airbnb. So it was like midnight. We're standing there, you know, and they like call Airbnb to figure out because they didn't know how long they would have to stay out. And the Airbnb person's like, well, can you prove this somehow? And then they're like, you know, can you like send us an email with the picture of like the do not cross line? And my friend Patrick, he says, just like go on Twitter and type Berlin bomb right now. And there's like dozens of stories about this exact same thing in this neighborhood. And they were like, no, we need a picture. And oh, can you have like a video of a police officer telling you that you can't go into the thing? Anyway, it turned out to be, they let them back in, but it was just really funny, like the reaction of this Airbnb support person. But yeah, it happens. I mean, I had a friend who was like a long time ago who, you know, during his university years was a lifeguard on the sort of northern beaches of France, right? So like Dunkirk, you know. Lots of people have heard that name of that city because of the movie. But in Dunkirk, you know, on the beach, they would often, you know, similarly also like find like these bombs that would get kind of unearthed with the water and the tides and everything. And then they would have to explode them. And what he told me they'd do is they'd put them on some sort of a raft and then they would just shoot at them when they were out in the ocean to like make them explode. I don't know if that's true, but yeah.
I've heard that like even on like, you know, sort of the east of France, like there's entire section, like giant sections that are basically like, you know, you can't cross them because they're, I don't know if it's true or not, but like, you know,
so that is true in that stuff exists. I don't know if it's true that there are actually unexploded munitions there. So for example, you know, in the north of France, so in so just north of Paris, like an hour north of Paris, between Paris and Lille, there's this town called Arras. Arras was a major stage during the, you know, First and Second World War. During the First World War, there were some major battles that were fought in the fields very near there called Vimy, in a place called Vimy. And Vimy in Canadian history is a very important place. In fact, it's on the $20 bill. Okay, so like, and Vimy has this monument, this massive monument that's, I don't know, maybe 20, 30 meters high. It's this beautiful, I think it's limestone monument with these like massive statues. There's a cemetery there. There's two cemeteries actually. And there was a, you know, a really important battle that was fought there, and the Canadians, like, you know, were victorious and managed to push back the Germans, etc. And in this place, there are still, there are still the trenches, and there's also the impact craters. And I'll
sorry, really quick, is this World War One or World War II?
World War One, yeah. And so the impact craters are still there, and it's really wild because like. there's a spot where you have the two trenches, the German trench and the like Allied forces trench, and they're whatever, like 10 meters across or something like that, like apart. And so the observation posts were that close, you know, like, you know, both sides were just really that close. And like in the middle, there's this huge impact crater that's maybe 4 or 5 meters deep. And it's just, you know, the entire place is just riddled with impact craters. But around there, so, you know, if you go to that place, which is actually like, it's like a Canadian national park in France. It's like, it belongs to Canada. Wow. There's all the land around it is kind of cordoned off with these little, these like short little fences, and there's just like sheep out in the woods. But you can't go out there because they say that there are unexploded munitions, and so that the sheep are, you know, like just out there kind of cutting the grass. But that's like one of the myths there is like that, you know, they always tell you don't go out into the forest because, you know, where the sheep are, because there could be unexploded munitions there. Yeah. And this is actually, so this is the place where, you know, there's this famous story where on Christmas Day or on Christmas Eve, during the First World War, the Germans and the Allied forces had a short ceasefire and they played soccer together and everything. Like, this is where that happened.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I watched the movie, for anyone who hasn't, I definitely recommend watching the movie 1917. I think it was like...
I downloaded it. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. It's beautiful. And it's just like such a... Like, you know, there's so many... like World War II war movies, and or at least in the US, like, you know, maybe in Europe it's different, but like there's not as much like representation of like World War One. Yeah. And I felt that was like a movie that like, oh wow, this is such a good depiction of what life was like on the front during like the First World War. And it's really interesting. And it's just cool how it kind of like, you know, it kind of showed how big of an impact the war has on an individual soldier, but then how like negligible of an impact any individual soldier has on the war.
Okay. Yeah. I'm going to watch it. I'm going to watch it tonight. I think.
Really cool.
Did you watch Contagion?
I did. And that was scary. I thought someone made like, you know, it felt like I was watching a documentary.
I know. It's so great. I mean, I watched it after you told me about it. And, you know, like, we were like, what the fuck? Like, how is this like, possible?
Yeah. Like, literally everything about, like, you know, the origins of the virus in that movie, the, you know, the government's initial, like, reactions. Just the way different quarantine situations were. It was just crazy how accurate it was. The only thing that made that movie different than real life, thank God, is that the mortality rate is much lower. But otherwise, that movie, it was just like, spooky to me.
Yeah, yeah. And like, and I think also one thing that, I mean, it's like for dramatic effect is, you know, the level of social unrest and like people you know, looting stores and like, you know, killing their neighbors for food, like I kind of, or for, yeah.
Yeah.
That kind of thing maybe goes a little bit off, but.
Yeah. One thing that kind of upset me about it, or about the meta of it is, you know, people explain, like, you know, this was, so this virus, like current situation was not this like unexpected thing. Like people literally were making movies about like similar things 10 years ago, and I don't know, I was just shocked that like how unprepared I like governments were. And like, you know, I thought the entire I assumed that like, you know, the point of having like 10,000 bureaucrats in Washington DC was that they're supposed to be like planning and prepping for all of these, like, you know, isn't that the whole point of like why we kind of, you know, the government sort of exists here, is to plan and prep for these disaster scenarios, whether it be a war or a pandemic or something. And they just felt utterly unprepared. And it's like, what? Yeah, I was just so shocked by that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that also in the movie, right? Like, people were just unprepared for it. Mm-hmm. I mean, as we were preparing for this, I've been thinking of this very thing, and you know, I think there's a lot of problems, but like one of the major problems is incentives, and that kind of cascades into all types of other, you know, issues. But like, for example, here in France, in the early 2000s, we had stockpiles of like billions and billions and billions of masks. Like, I don't know the exact numbers, but like there were masks for the entire population to like live on for several, maybe weeks or something. And successive governments since then have depleted those stockpiles, you know, to like sell them to other countries and like reduce deficit basically. And you know, they sold off our, you know, the thing that was meant mm-hmm. to protect us, you know, for financial or fiscal reasons or whatever. And then, you know, the current government sort of had the balls to come out and say, oh no, like masks don't protect you, you know? Mm-hmm. So like the incentives aren't there, you know, to prepare for a pandemic, you know, years ahead that could never come. You know, that's I think like one of the big issues with this, like our political system is not set up to align the incentives of politicians with the long-term incentives of society.
Yeah. Like even that, you know, I guess we were going to talk about this more next time, but that A16Z article, I felt like, you know, it was saying like, oh, why isn't the US have 10 times ICU beds and stuff? But it's like, why would the US build and store 10 times ICU beds? That's not, you know, like unless the government is paying for it, it's just not an economically viable thing.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Well, maybe let's unpack this a little bit. Like, so, you know, there's like short-term upsides and like long-term upsides. And humans are just inherently bad at doing like long-term planning. And you know, I was listening to this Sam Harris podcast this week, and the topic was habit formation, and it's kind of similar to habit formation where, you know, things that generally make you feel good in the short term are like those that make you that are bad for you in the long term, and those that don't make you feel good in the short term or where you feel bad in the short term are good for you in the long term. So like working out, for example, is one of these things. Like, you know, it sucks to work out in the short term, but in the long term, like it's good for you. But it, like smoking right now, the damage that a cigarette will do on you short term, you know, is fairly low, but long term it'll be bad for you. But it's really cool to smoke a cigarette. And I think like this kind of reflects a little bit of the dynamics in politics, is like the things that are good for politicians short term are often misaligned with the things that like will benefit society long term. And I think that has to do just with like the human, you know, the state of humans. Like it's a human condition to seek short-term rewards.
Do you think it's also a consequence of our political system as well, though, especially, you know, at least, you know, with democratic countries that have sort of short election terms where, you know, you're only thinking on a 4-year time horizon until your next election?
Well, how much of that is a consequence of this human condition of looking for short-term benefits? You know, is the political system of you know, of like short political terms not a condition of or a consequence of this human condition of looking for short-term benefits? I don't know.
In maybe. What way would it be? Why would it be? That doesn't, I mean, I feel like the, so whose benefit would that be? Like, it's not in the politicians' benefits. They would probably want it to be longer, and I feel for the people, you know, it was meant sort of as an anti-tyranny mechanism. What does that relate? How does that relate to like sort of the human desires?
Yeah, maybe it doesn't relate that much to human desires. It's probably more of a like anti-tyranny mechanism than you know, human desire mechanism. But I think like in the political mechanism where, you know, we seek change and we seek short-term rewards, you know, there might be some underlying, you know, some somewhat subconscious, you know, motivations to having shorter demographic, or, you know, not moving towards longer election terms simply because like people would want to, you know, be able to have change like fairly often. Yeah, I mean, this is not a very like well-formed theory, but perhaps, yeah, perhaps it's.
I mean, like, do you think longer election term, or do you think that like the sort of, even if we ignore like sort of the like politicians, like, but still like, you know, the bureaucrats are sort of the same even across like presidential administrations and stuff. And so,
yeah,
you know, why are the bureaucrats not having these sort of longer term time horizons?
Well, they do, don't they? I mean, the bureaucrats do.
I mean, but aren't they sort of the ones who would have been preparing for coronavirus situation, like entities like the CDC and whatnot?
Yeah, they should have, right? But you know, their planning also needs to align with you know, the policies that are enacted by the governments that are elected every four to 6 years, right? So whatever budgets they might have, or emergency preparedness budgets or things like that, like that stuff doesn't like change. It doesn't change the fact that a politician in the US, for example, like a president, is there for 8 years, and then within 8 years he has like a whole bunch of things to plan and to do, and like planning for a pandemic that may or may not come is not one of those things. Now that probably changed now, like now that we've had it and we've reacted to it and we know that these things will come, like I think there will be a general trend towards governments implementing, you know, widespread pandemic preparedness measures, you know, stockpiling masks, you know, installing within their arsenal of like legal tools the ability to enact quarantine at a moment's notice. So like, you know, we can go into like the effects that we'll have on civil liberties, etc. So I think like now is the time where we're going to see that sort of shift.
Yeah, sure. So yeah, let's chat about that. So I mean, last week you sort of hosted the Reset Everything event.
Yeah.
Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so like Reset Everything was it last week? No, it was a week before. It was 2 weeks ago. I had this idea like in March, to right around confinement. I thought, okay, it would be a cool idea to get a bunch of people in crypto that don't necessarily align, that would certainly not fly to a different city to meet up, right? Let's get these opposing kind of like forces within crypto in some kind of virtual conference, because like they might not fly to a conference, but they'll, like, the likelihood that they'll go to a, you know, a virtual conference is probably quite high. And so that was the idea. And then very quickly I thought, okay, wait, there's just like so much more to talk about here than crypto and how the coronavirus pandemic is affecting our industry. Let's just go all out and like just make this a multidisciplinary event, and where you know, we can address all kinds of things, like monetary policy, governance, healthcare, work and collaboration, and a bunch of other, you know, privacy and like a bunch of other areas that I thought were interesting. And that was basically it. I was like, okay, I'm going to do an event. It's going to happen on this day. So, mm-hmm. It was co-organized with Alex Masmej, who's like a prominent figure in DeFi for having tokenized himself, and the team at Yap Global also helped out a lot. And yeah, so we just like started contacting people that were, you know, competent in all of these areas I mentioned.
Mm-hmm. And so you got quite a few people. You had like, and a lot of like non-crypto people as well, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of like, I don't want to say it was a goal, but when I started planning it and I started seeing the kinds of people that were confirming, less and less I wanted it to be about crypto. And like, we were going to have a crypto panel, but there were just mm-hmm. so many really kind of cool people being confirmed on all these other topics that at some point, like, the agenda just filled up and I was like, well, I guess that goes to crypto panel. So, you know, I mean, like, there were some crypto people within those, you know, within those panels. Like, there was definitely crypto people at the conference. People we've had on podcasts before, like Mark Miller and Robin Hanson. Okay, although like they're not super crypto, but like, you know, we had Harry Halpin, he's working on the NIM protocol. Like Brian Bellendorf spoke as well. But yeah, it wasn't like, there wasn't a lot of like the DeFi crowd or like the Bitcoin crowd or yeah. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we had about 30 speakers. The website's still up, it's resetEverything.events. Lots of great speakers like Jeff Jarvis, who's a professor of journalism at CUNY, Azim Azar, who writes Exponential View, this great newsletter. Cory Doctorow also spoke. And then we had, you know, like some psychologists, doctors, just like we had a VC panel. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was really cool. It was like, it was a really interesting group of speakers that just kind of came together around this and explored like all kinds of areas. We even had like, we had a panel, like I guess like the panel that was the most far out was like, was on the topic of treating mental illness with psychedelics in the wake of COVID. That was definitely the one that like really stood out as maybe further away from the, you know, topic at hand, but it was still really uh-huh. cool. Yeah.
How related was that to COVID, or was it just people talking about psychedelics in general?
It was mostly talking about psychedelics, but it was like competent people talking about psychedelics. Like, so we had like the director of the Mind Foundation, which is like this European nonprofit that does a lot of work around psychedelics. And then another, you know, psychologist, like two other psychologists in North America. And it was like a really, really fascinating panel.
So maybe what we could do is sort of across all of these topics that you sort of were covered at the event, maybe what we can do is maybe go through each of them and sort of maybe you could tell us what you thought were sort of the one or two best insights on each of those topics.
Okay. Yeah.
So, okay, let's start with future of work and collaboration. So, you know, there's all this talk nowadays about, oh, everything's going remote. Having worked at a remote company for the past 3 years, you know, I have some thoughts on that as well.
But yeah.
What were some of the takeaways from the event on future of work and collaboration?
Yeah, I think that was the topic that was less covered directly. I really wanted to get like a sociologist or someone, you know, like an academic to come and talk about that. But in the end, we didn't find anyone who addressed the kind of core issue there. But it did kind of permeate throughout the rest of the conference, you know, in all of the talks, really. And, you know, the things that really came out there that stood out are that companies that, you know, there's definitely like a shift towards digital that, you know, would have taken 10 years to happen and then happened basically in 10 days. And that, you know, companies are shifting to remote work. You know, like we've all seen the tweets from people saying like, hey, I'm leaving San Francisco because like I've hated this place all along and I've just had to be here for work. But now that I can actually work remotely, I'm splitting.
Yeah.
So that, I think is really the trend is, you know, we needed a pandemic to, you know, show the world basically, but like for companies to realize that they can work remotely and that the sky doesn't fall on their heads. And it's, there are varying degrees to which like people are adapting to it. I think, you know, the younger startup kind of workforce that is used to remote work and is like is used to digital tools is probably faring a lot better than companies with perhaps like an older workforce. I've seen that just around me and like my friends and who work for various companies. But you know, one of the things that Ryan Selkis said is that, you know, people have realized that like online life is real life. Like online work is real work. Online school is real school. And that needs to resonate now with policies in terms of incorporating this reality, this online reality into like our everyday lives. So whether that means providing access to high-speed internet across, you know, across the board to everyone. And I'm talking there about sort of the inequalities that are, that this pandemic has shed light on. So as a side example, you know, like here in France, there's a system in place for remote school, like for school to take place over these like online platforms, but you know, like some double digit number of kids don't have computers at home. Yeah. So like,
yeah.
How do we make up for that? And how do we have policies that allow people to effectively, you know, go to school online if they need to?
Yeah. Did you have any discussion on sort of future of on like remote work, but in like other, like, you know, more in like third world countries? Cause I know like one of the issues, like, you know, let's take like India, for example, you know, India is like famous for its like call centers and stuff.
Yeah.
But one of the problems is that, you know, these call centers are these like giant buildings that have like, you know, a lot of computers and everything, but the people who work in them actually, you oftentimes sometimes don't even have like electricity in their own houses.
Yeah.
Or they don't have computer access in their own houses. So how, you know, for a lot of third world countries, it seems that the workplace was sort of this like hub of, you know, access to the outside world. So did that come up at all?
No, it didn't come up. That's a really great point though. That's a really interesting thing that I had not considered because yeah, of course here, like everybody, you know, you call people now and like you call like your insurance company and like, you just know that the guy's sitting in his living room. Right. yeah. In India and like perhaps like sub-Saharan African countries, places like that, that's most likely the case. Yeah. Do you know of anyone who's like looking into this or talking about this?
No, I don't. We should maybe look into it and then share it maybe next time.
Yeah. 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 So on the remote work thing, that was kind of like the overarching topic.
Yeah. So, okay. What about, did you guys touch any bit on education?
No, not specifically. So we were going to have a track about education, but you know, in terms of the speakers that we were able to secure, we didn't. So so here were the topics. So work and collaboration, tech and privacy, media and journalism, health and wellness, money and economics, and then politics and governance. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. I mean, so on education though, just like, you know, on your thoughts, like what do you think is going to happen sort of, you know, this is education is something I've been personally looking into quite a bit more recently. Mm-hmm. And so what do you, you know, it's kind of my sister, her high school is basically over for then until the end of the year now.
Yeah.
And you know, it seems that, I think I just yesterday, the University of California, chancellor said that, like, you know, don't, you should expect that schools probably, the colleges probably won't be open in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, what do you think? Do you think this is going to, like, this whole un-college movement that's been going on for a while, do you think this is going to exacerbate it?
Oh, probably, yeah. I think that this, like, is one of those trends that, yeah, like, you know, Azim Azar's whole talk was basically about how the COVID crisis hasn't created new trends, but is just accelerating deeper secular trends. And I think this is one of those deep secular trends that will accelerate. Mm-hmm. For sure. I mean, more so in some places than others, just depending on where you are and the importance that society puts on college education. But, you know, in places like the US, then probably.
So, okay. So is there any trend that you think it is going to reverse? Like, you know, the name Reset Everything makes it, if it's just sort of an acceleration of existing trends, that doesn't sound very resetting per se. So what would you say is a trend that, like, you think is probably going to get reversed because of this?
Well, you know, the trends that are accelerating at the same time have some resetting effects, you know, so the remote work trend, I think, it sort of resets families in a way, especially families where you have parents working and, you know, children either going to school or at home. And I think for a lot of families, this is going to reset the family dynamics. It's going to, you know, allow parents to spend more time with their kids, have, you know, closer relationships with their kids. You know, overnight, 15,000 children in France went from, or, sorry, 15 million children went from their school to the kitchen table. You know, if you're a parent and you're now having to think about how you educate your child in a much more hands-on way than you did previously. I think that's like a big reset for a lot of people.
Yeah. So I guess,
yeah,
you know, maybe back to like the 1917 thing, it's like, you know, it's a continuation of a macro trend, but it's going to, like, a lot of individuals are going to be feeling it a lot more. It's going to be a resetting for more at the micro level, at the individual level. And the macro trend is going to affect a lot more people much more quickly.
Yeah. Then there's this, I think there's this other kind of general trend that people have been talking about, which is this kind of slowing down trend, right? Where, you know, if we're not commuting to work or if we're commuting a lot less than we usually would, then that would probably have some beneficial effects on people. Individually, just in terms of their stress level, in terms of their ability to take time to, you know, to do hobbies and things like that. And at the same time, it has a broader impact on, say, things like the environment, you know, congestion of roads and highways and this sort of thing. Now, you know, I think the elephant in a room here is that while everyone's talking about remote work and talking about how it's great because, like, you know, it kind of resets families and it forces you to slow down and all this stuff, that only applies to a certain portion of the population. And that is, you know, people who work in knowledge work. I think we need to recognize that service sector workers are likely not to benefit as much from these trends as those who work in knowledge in the knowledge space. Mm-hmm. And yeah, these are people who are, you know, typically, you know, have lower income, like in the US, you know, they were confronted with the virus a lot more than knowledge workers. I mean, this is a huge problem because these are people who often lack proper health care. They do have to commute. So I think like one of the things here in this crisis is that it's really shed light on social inequalities. Yeah.
Okay. So one of the other topics was tech and privacy. So what were some of the interesting takeaways from that one?
Yeah. So on the privacy side, there are, so like Cory Doctorow gave this really inspiring talk about the opportunities for a resurgence of cypherpunk ideologies. And then there was also a panel that kind of went into the nitty gritty of all of these privacy, like the questions around privacy and like tracking and this sort of thing. I think one of the takeaways for me was that, you know, we're going to have to be much more careful with our data than we had to already. And already we had to have like a pretty, we had to be pretty careful about our data.
But what do you think about the whole contact tracing initiative that was done by Google and Apple?
I don't know that much about it, to be honest.
It seems surprisingly privacy preserving to me. Mm-hmm. Like, it was the architecture of the system. It was designed in such, so I can give it from what my understanding, you know, I'm not even sure if this is completely correct, but from what I understood is happening is what happened is your phone would sort of be broadcasting some sort of encrypted message, with like your identifier.
Yeah.
And whenever someone else's phone is in like nearby, it will basically log that, hey, look, I have this signed sort of message from this identifier. And then you can kind of keep, but from taking one of the phones, you can kind of look at like, okay, who all has been in contact with this person by looking at like, okay, whose identifiers has this phone been near? This actually was like, seemed like a surprisingly like privacy conscious solution. It's not perfect, but it's like, you know, better than like tracking everyone's GPS coordinates and sharing it with the government directly.
Yeah. I mean, I think like that kind of approach makes sense if we are to have some kind of contact tracing thing. I mean, I think the issue here is most people, I mean, it's I think in a lot of places it's meant to be voluntary. So does it even achieve the goal of contact tracing if, you know, such a small percent of the population would presumably engage in it? Mm-hmm. And then there's just the other question, which kind of relates to privacy in a little bit, which is more around, you know, creating these divides between people who have been infected and those who haven't. So this kind of comes back to the movie, right, where you had this mm-hmm. bracelet, and you know, if you had the bracelet, you could get around, but if you didn't have the bracelet, then mm-hmm. then you couldn't, presumably, and it kind of creates like two classes of people, and mm-hmm. yeah, that kind of has like some privacy implications, right? So it means that, okay, if you don't have the bracelets, then if you don't have the bracelet, if you're not, then you're not immune, then, you know, like presumably you could be a carrier of the virus, and like that puts you in a position of, puts you in a complicated place, right? in a complicated position.
Okay. So what about now sort of money and economics? So obviously, you know, like we mentioned, there's a lot of crypto people at the event and, you know, all the crypto people are suddenly macroeconomists now. So what were some of their sort of, what were some of the takeaways and insights from that section?
Yeah, so I think the my favorite talk here was Jim Bianco's talk. Jim Bianco is a global global macroeconomist. He heads a firm called Bianco Research in the U.S. They provide research and analysis to institutional finance and like financial actors in the financial sector. So like very plugged into like global macroeconomics. And we're actually going to get him on the podcast in a couple of weeks. So I'm super excited about. And he had a talk about the Fed and whether or not the Fed was making it better. And discussing the kind of impact that like subsequent Fed bailouts could have on the economy. So I like really, I'm not going to like try to summarize what his talk, but anybody who's interested in that kind of thing should definitely listen to him. It's like a super fascinating talk. And
what was the general direction? Was he, do you think the Fed was doing the right thing right now, or are they doing the wrong thing right now?
So that I think it was more about like the risk that the Fed starts buying up, starts buying assets. You know, this is what I'm hearing from a lot of these global macro folks, mostly through the Macro Voices podcast. I don't know if you subscribe to that, but you should. And their fears that the Fed starts buying up assets in the market, and and if that's the case, then like everything just goes to zero, basically. Like inflation would run rampant, and we'd end up in a banana republic, essentially.
Well, what about this whole money printer go brr? Is that like a legitimate concern? Like, you know, it seems to me that it seems that the situation is that yes, the US, you know, just printed $3 trillion, but like, you know, the US had the ability to do so. The state of the US central bank is better than every other central bank. Like, I would say the US Fed is sort of one of the only central banks that actually recovered from 2008 and actually managed to bring its interest rates like up, while every other country was like interest rates were still stuck at 0% post 2008. And so the US Fed actually had the ability to print. And if they did, was it not, you know, what was the alternative other that, you know, was should the US Fed not have enacted monetary policy to like combat the current situation?
I don't know. That's I mean, like, I think there's different, there's kind of opposing views on this. And one, like the opposing view to like, you know, should have the Fed, like that the Fed, you know, that print all this money, is that we should have just let the economy figure it out by itself and like let weak companies go bankrupt and let weak banks go bankrupt and like let's emerge from this crisis stronger, because like we would have come up with like more robust, like a more robust economy. You know, I don't know if that's a better option, but certainly I think that just, you know, printing money probably will have negative effects long term, but you know, we're not going to feel them, because it's just we won't feel them directly unless like this all just kind of swings back the other way. If you know, if the U.S. continues to have kind of monetary dominance, then probably Americans won't feel it that much. But the result is that we have an economy that is still kind of fragile and that can swing, you know, in the face of these kinds of pandemics, like the economy isn't robust essentially, and like we'll just need to keep printing money when this kind of stuff happens. Whereas if there was maybe some kind of like in like some approach somewhere in the middle where, okay, we let some companies fail, like we let airlines fail. Okay, like there'll be a new model for airlines. Okay, fine. Who cares if airlines fail? Let's help those who need it, like those who are in the street or like can't pay their, can't buy food or whatever. Let's help out individuals to the best of our ability. But like, I don't think we should be bailing out, you know, massive companies.
Yeah,
that's just my opinion.
I agree here. Like, I'm less worried about the inflation coming from this because I think there's just been such a increase in global demand for dollars as well that it's actually not going to cause that much inflation in the U.S. But what I think the larger concern is sort of this question of how these resources were going to be distributed. And it, I think it was like something like 70 to 80% of all of this, like, you know, printing was being this, you know, helicopter money was being dropped to help like large corporations.
Yeah.
And I think that's, I think that the question of, I don't know what to call, I guess this is this kind of, I guess this technically falls under the definition of monetary economics, but it's sort of almost this like halfway middle thing between monetary and fiscal policy, where it's fiscal policy done through monetary policy, where you're making these like decisions on, you know, instead of like figuring out who to give tax like benefits and bailouts and stuff to, it's sort of who to give this helicopter money drop to. But
yeah,
it's not as it's not the like sort of very traditional Friedman style sense of monetary economics where, oh, fiscal economics is this like, you know, the government has to make all these decisions and play favorites. And no, monetary economics is, looks so much more pure. It's just like, you know, we have this one little lever, which is the interest rate, and we're just playing with that. And, you know, it's a neutral policy mechanism, which it seems that's just not the case anymore. I mean, it probably never was the case, but it's more so not the case, where it seems that there's a lot of actual decision making that has to go into it now.
Yeah. What do you think of this idea that, because you said that that 70% of it was like going to the corporations. Is that something you kind of support, or would you have rather seen a more, you know, bottom up approach where we give more money directly to individuals instead of companies?
To be quite honest, I'm not sure, because, you know, obviously the gut reaction thing, we're like, oh no, we should be giving more money to the individuals. But to be quite honest, I'm not sure I am familiar enough with sort of what the second order effects and the deeper intricacies enough to sort of judge the decisions that were made. I would say that it is great that essentially, you know, Andrew Yang like lost the Democratic primary, but, you know, it seems that the Republican Party became the party of UBI now.
Yeah.
Or like there's essentially a UBI happening now, but under a under the Trump administration. And I wonder if this is a trend that will continue post COVID, that like this notion, whether COVID started sort of a UBI in the US and whether this will keep on going afterwards. If so, that would be sort of a very interesting side effect of this whole situation.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Are they doing anything similar to that in Europe?
So yes and no. So I don't, in the US, I think they're just straight up giving cash to people, right? It's just like, here's $1,000 or whatever. Mm-hmm. Here, it's more akin to like unemployment benefits. Mm-hmm. And so companies are benefiting companies that have to kind of quote unquote lay off their employees. Like, say you work at a restaurant, your restaurants are closed right now. Well, employees will get, well, like their salaries are essentially paid for by the government up to a certain percentage. So, so it's a form of unemployment. It just doesn't come out of the, it doesn't come out of like the kind of the, like the unemployment budget. It's like another like it's another pool of money. I don't think that the government's just giving money to individuals directly. Maybe in some cases, I think there's some. So, for example, those who work at supermarkets and need it to be in touch with the public, for example, I think they're getting some kind of a bonus or some kind of a, you know, if they worked full time, like they'll get like $1,000 or something. Mm-hmm. But it's not for everyone. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But I would say the distinction here, at least in France, is that people haven't been laid off. You know, when we hear, okay, like 30 some million people in the US filed for unemployment this month, that's because they were laid off. Like they lost their jobs. Mm-hmm. People here haven't lost their jobs. They still have their jobs.
Why is that?
Because, well, because you can't, it's a lot harder to fire people here. Mm-hmm. And because the government told employers, like, don't fire employees. We'll just pay their salaries for them. While this crisis passes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how's it sort of, do you know, how is it sort of affecting some of the more troubled European countries like, you know, Greece and stuff? We're already sort of, you know, not doing so hot pre-virus. How are they, you know, what the situation with them is?
I don't know. I have no idea. I've not followed the situation in other countries as closely as I perhaps should have.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay. So, okay, question on that then, right? Like, I guess related to politics and governance now is, what effect do you think this is having on the EU? Where, you know, I felt this, that like, you know, for the EU to work, there needs to be sort of this pan-Europeanism. But everything I've seen from like the response to COVID, everyone has sort of retreated back to like the national level. All the responses are being done at the national level. I don't know. Are borders closed? Can people easily travel between European countries?
It depends on the countries. Yeah.
So what do you think is like, what impact is this having on the EU, experiment?
So from a purely kind of like, you know, open borders perspective, you know, some countries have closed their borders. So let's go outwards in. The borders of Schengen are closed. So you can't fly to Europe right now, for example, unless you have a good reason. And then countries individually have decided to close their borders with some countries. So, for example, Germany has closed its borders with France. So someone going into Germany from France, and not just France, but other countries, Germany has closed their borders with like 10 countries, I think. But if you, I did this, like I went to Germany during this crisis. I had to go through border control at the airport, which is you know, I've never seen that before. it's kind of unsettling. And I had to present like a valid reason for going to Germany. Mm-hmm. On the other, going the other way around though, Germany has not closed its borders with France. Or sorry, France has not closed its borders with Germany. And so going from Germany to France is relatively easy.
Oh, wow.
Now, when you get here, so like, let's say 2 weeks ago, when we were in confinement, so in order to go to Germany, I have to have a justification. I have to have a reason. Because first of all, I need a reason to be just leaving my house. I need a reason to go outside. I need a reason to go to the airport. If I get stopped on the way, I need to be able to give a valid reason for why I'm even outdoors, let alone flying to another country. And then when I arrived in Germany, show a reason for why I'm going to Germany. But then within the country, I can do as I please because there's no confinement. And then the other way around is like, you can fly to Germany, just you can fly from Germany to France just fine, but you, once you arrive here, you need to show a reason for like why you're here. So it's like, you know, that that's just one experience between two countries, but that's kind of like what it looks like. I think the other question is, and I'm not like the most, I haven't done like a lot of research into this, but you know, if you're looking at countries like Italy and Spain, like the economic impact that this has on Italy and Spain might make it hard for them to stay in the EU long term. So, you know, it costs money to be in the EU. It's like states have to like pay their share to the EU, and you know, if they're unable to do that, then that might put the European projects in perspective. Like it might break apart from that perspective. Yeah.
So do you think these borders, like, you know, closed borders, are going to continue long term, or are they sort of just a temporary short term thing?
I mean, Germany's opening their borders next month. So I don't think that will, I mean, some states might decide, like, you know, on the extreme side, like Hungary might decide that they keep their borders closed or something. I don't know if they are, but like, you know, that would be, it wouldn't be out of character for like Hungary to say like, no, we're keeping our borders closed. But as far as I know, that's not the case.
What about from like just sort of a mentality side? Like, you know, like I said, it seems that all the coordination was done at the nation level rather than at a sort of European level. Do you think that, you know, I'm a bit of a Eurosceptic. I think that to make the EU work, there really needs to be a larger pan-European movement.
Yeah.
Like a sense of nationalism at the European level.
Yeah.
And do you think this has helped push towards that or away from that?
I'm not sure. My gut tells me probably pushes away from that, but maybe in the short term, perhaps not so much in the long term. I think a lot of it has to do with what's going to happen with like Italy and Spain and the countries that have been the hardest hit, and you know, what is their role in the European project long term. I think that will determine much of what happens next. I think in the short term we'll see less traveling cross borders, just because I think people are generally going to be a little bit less inclined to, you know, get on a plane or this sort of thing for at least the next year or so. I think that just kind of like follows the trends of, you know, like airlines hurting in the next in the next few years. Okay. And so, you know, what are the kind of offshoot effects of that? And there's this really great body of research called low touch economy. So if you go to lowtoucheconomy.com, it's a consultancy in, I think, Amsterdam called Board of Innovation. And when this whole thing started, they began doing this research about the low touch economy, and they've written these reports, and there's like a really great Slack group where people are talking about this, and they built this mind map. Let me just download it here because I don't have it on my computer, but they built this really great mind map of like, which has all of the impacts of this, of like the low touch economy. By low touch economy, I mean like an economy in which like people are, you know, socially distancing and are not in like physical contact as much as they usually are. Sorry, I'm like downloading this while I'm talking to you. And there are a couple of things here that when I first saw this, I was like, huh, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of that before. And one of the things is the rise of nationalism and authoritarianism as a result of the crisis. So the way that they put it is, if there's social distancing and less travel, more traveling within borders, less traveling abroad, then there's potentially like less cohesion between countries, less business with other European countries. Studying abroad is kind of put into question, etc. And why am I not receiving this? And that, like, one of the, you know, kind of far away long-term effects of this is, you know, some nationalism, perhaps even racism, begins to rise. And yeah, I think like it's kind of like a lot of things need to happen for that to really become a big problem in ways that we've seen, like, you know, in the last 70 years or so. But yeah, it's like a possibility, right? That we might see a rise in racism or more like nationalism.
Sounds like yet another example of accelerating of trends.
Yeah, could be. Yeah.
So what were some of the from the conference? What were some of the talks that on other talk? Were there like sort of other topics that were covered in politics and governance?
From the politics and government side of things, let's see here. There was this one last minute speaker who came, someone had to bail at the last moment. A guy named Ash Milton. He's the managing editor at Palladium magazine. And he gave this really fascinating.
I love their podcast as well.
I discovered it at Reset Everything, but yeah, he gave a really fascinating talk about the rise of the what he calls the Asian model, or like it was called forking of the Asian model, where he essentially defines the Asian model, right? So like the Asian economic model and governance model, and how that model is gaining traction and is gaining influence in the West. Predominantly in Africa at the moment, I think is like the place where, you know, it has most direct influence, but also in like other places around the world. So it's really great.
Sorry, could you quickly define what the Asian model means? Because I feel the governance system of China is very different than that of Taiwan.
Yes.
Which is very different than that of Singapore.
So that's a big part of his talk, is kind of differentiating those different models, but also where they're similar. And how they're kind of, you know, forking from one country to the other. And, you know, each of those countries has, you know, sort of like the each of those countries' models has their strengths, their individual strengths, and but that they, you know, they kind of have a similar roots, I guess, and so they've kind of all forked in a way. If you, you know, if you kind of compare it to this idea of forking, they've kind of all forked from like a very similar
what
place.
What would be the unifying theme of their governance models?
I mean, you should check out the talk, but you know, the unifying themes, I think, are you know, he talks about like obviously like China and the very kind of top-down approach that they have, but then comparing that to Singapore, and you know, being a relatively like very open kind of economy, but still like held together by a strong governing force. And then, you know, in Taiwan, like I don't know Taiwan that well, like personally, but the way he describes it is like in Taiwan, people have a very strong sense of trust in the government. And so people tend to just kind of trust what the government says. And there's this like very strong civic sense of civic duty and responsibility. And so like, it was a really cool talk. One of my favorite talks I want to mention is a talk by Cécile Montet. So she's a friend of mine, and she's a doctor here in Paris. She's an emergency pediatrician, and she gave like this super inspiring talk about basically what it's like being on the front lines. Mm-hmm. There's lots here. So I would invite everybody to check it out on YouTube. Just search for Reset Everything and you'll find the YouTube page. And here's the mind map, the low touch economy mind map. Yeah. So one of the things in this low touch economy mind map is, limited large gatherings as an outcome of the low touch economy, like ripple effects of the low touch economy, limited large gatherings. And then as an offshoot of that is like work from home. And then as a consequence of that, less commuting. And as a consequence of that, drop in podcasting / music streaming.
Yeah. So this is something I kind of asked you, before, like right when all of this stuff was starting, was, do you think our epicenter numbers will go up or down because of this? Because less people are commuting and whatnot. So what was the result of that? Do you know what the impact was?
It's pretty stable. Yeah. I mean, we were on a, I guess like a downward trend since a little while, like there were like a number of factors that were playing into that, but some which have to do with like some audience dropping off. Some also have to do with just the way that we're accounting for listeners. But we're kind of stable at the moment.
Okay.
Yeah.
So not sure. So it didn't have too much of an impact on that, I guess.
Not so far. I mean, I haven't noticed like a big drop. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And also speaking of the large gatherings, you know, what happened to those Hong Kong protests and stuff?
Remember, I don't know. I think they're over.
Yeah. Like that, as soon as, you know, I wonder if a lot of, you know, same with in Barcelona, there was a lot of protests at the beginning of the year.
Yeah.
I wonder if like that stuff is going to come back, or a lot of those movements are just got completely smothered.
I don't know. I keep thinking, so I've been walking around my neighborhood here, and like the kind of suburb I live in is a predominantly left-leaning suburb with historically a strong worker class. I know this is going to sound for like U.S. people, the municipal government is a communist municipal government. It has been for since forever, of like the French Communist Party.
Whoa.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, like, there are communist parties here, but, like, it's, you know, it doesn't resonate with what, like, you know, an American would, like, think of, like...
That's not the same connotation.
Not the same connotation, I think, you know. Yeah. But, yeah, I'll just as a side note, like, the Communist Party is stronger in municipal... in like the municipal seats than in like any other, you know, level of government. which I think makes sense, like to have like strong left leaning like local government. But anyway, why was I talking about this? Right, because just walking through the streets, you know, there's kind of like people hang out their windows, these banners of support for you know, for the healthcare workers, etc. Like, you know, you see this slogan everywhere, like plus de fric pour l'hôpital public, which means like more money for public hospitals. And I've been noticing a lot of slogans like, you know, like we'll see you in the streets kind of thing. Like, so I feel that, you know, there's kind of a subtext of an impending renewal of the Gilets Jaunes, of all of these social movements that, you know, took place before all of this. And I kind of hear it also, you know, I'll be walking down the street and I'll hear someone like singing the Gilets Jaunes songs, like from their window or whatever. Yeah. So I think, and given also the trust, sorry.
I said just that entire image just felt so French.
Yeah. I mean, given also the level of trust that, like, in surveys, you know, like a large portion of the population basically like has lost trust in the government for like how they handle this crisis, and like they probably most blatantly lied, like most likely lied about a lot of things, and the fact that schools are open again now, just like, you know, they're saying we need to open schools, but everybody knows it's because we need the economy to pick up again. That I think will probably act as a spark for the renewal of these social movements.
It's interesting that in the U.S. that's actually more of a right wing movement. Or true, no, I don't want to use the term right wing here, but you know, it seems mostly like Republicans and Trump supporters who are like sort of demanding that the economy be reopened like ASAP, and like they're the ones who are sort of like marching on like demanding that and stuff. And so it's interesting that it's like
I think the working Republican class has a lot in common with the working left-wing class.
That's true.
You know, I think they're very similar. They just they're just aligned they're aligned through different sort of messages, right? Like I mean, even here, I think like the working right-wing class has a lot in common with the working left-wing class.
Okay, so let's run through these last two topics really quick. So the next one was media and journalism.
So this was another great speaker. So we had Jeff Jarvis on. So Jeff Jarvis is a professor of journalism at CUNY. I've spent the last 15 years listening to him and his co-hosts on This Week in Google and the Twit Network. In fact, most of my podcasting career has been inspired by these people. So it was like a real honor to have him. He gave a talk as well about sort of trust in journalism and, you know, how we can renew trust in journalism. And the challenges there, you know, with regards to like spreading of fake news and this sort of thing. We also had a panel about the role of journalism in the time of crisis, which was interesting because we had like two academics, one media person, one Ryan Selkis, which took the point of view of the citizen journalist and then the broadcast journalist.
Yeah, it was interesting. Yeah. I was there for that panel and for Jeff's talk, and it was interesting to watch Jeff and Ryan.
Yeah. Sort of what did you think of that?
I kind of have, you know, I guess I personally tend to agree a bit more with Ryan's view, but I think there's like sort of this mix where I think we, you know, I mean, one of my passions is like Web of Trust, and I think that there needs to be sort of more Web of Trust style things where, you know, citizen, you know, traditional credentials for journalism aren't great. Citizen journalism is great. But then I think it falls, you know, there's this thing called the paradox of abundance, which is when the amount of content increases, the average content, the quality of the mean content goes down, but the quality of the top content goes up.
Right.
And so citizen journalism is sort of, it creates a paradox of abundance where the average citizen journalism is probably much worse than the average
journalist, you
know, traditional journalism, but maybe the best is actually better. And so we need better curation. And I think sort of Web of Trust's style, reputation, or, you know, just, yeah, I think this, you know, some of the stuff that I'm personally working on right now I'm thinking more on the education side, but how to solve this theory of abundance, this paradox of abundance problem where like more curation is what's needed. Yeah. I think maybe we'll do another episode.
We'll do a proper episode. Yeah. So that kind of wraps up the topics here. I mean, I guess, health and wellness. Cecile, she gave a great talk. And then we had some other talks around like psychedelics, and we had a talk with a psychologist, who was talking about kind of like dealing with anxiety within this crisis. Amesh Adalja, who's a senior scholar at Johns Hopkins, also came to talk about how this virus spreads. So yeah, check it out. Check out the talks on the YouTube page. Reset Everything that events. The YouTube link is there. And then, yeah. So then the outcome of this is that I'm thinking of starting a podcast. Here's kind of like my high level situation at the moment. I'm getting somewhat, I don't want to say uninterested, but like, you know, I've been in crypto for 6 years now, and I feel that they're 6.5 years, and I just all my focus has gone into crypto. And I feel that there's just so many other things that I'm interested in and that I would love to explore. And, you know, and I would love to have another, like a venue where I can just do that, because Epicenter, you know, I don't think Epicenter is the right place to do that. Right. And so like having another podcast where I can, you know, have, sort of a doctor if I want to, or, any other person that I find interesting is something I would really like. So I'm thinking about that at the moment, what I would like that to look like, what the format would be. Mm-hmm. And, hopefully probably launching something in May or June.
We should do one on the, you know, crypto burnout that you were talking about. Cause I haven't been in the space as long as you have, but I feel even I'm feeling it a little bit as well.
And I mean, it's just, it's more, who was I talking to about this the other day? Oh yeah. With Alex. It's like, I don't know. I mean, I think that there's so many things in crypto, like crypto, the space itself has grown so much in the last 6 years. Like the space is bigger and bigger and bigger, and it's getting bigger and bigger. And there's just so much stuff within that space, you know, now. And there's just more and more things. But it remains a big bubble. Like, in terms of the its applications, and it's not, I'm not talking about like a financial bubble. I'm talking about a bubble in the sense that it hasn't branched out outside of that community as much as I would have hoped. You know, I would have thought by now, you know, that crypto would be used, usage of crypto would be far long, you know, further into the in adoption than we are now, which is like adoption of crypto right now is basically the same as it was 3 or 4 years ago.
Yep.
You know, that needle hasn't moved very much. And we you know, we're building so many great things, so many great technologies, so many interesting technologies, and they're all super useful, I'm sure. I'm sure there's all kinds of applications, but it remains a big bubble. And that is where, when I started realizing that, when I started saying like, okay, where are the monthly active, like, where are the, why aren't we looking at monthly active non-crypto nerds as a metric for how the crypto space is doing? Well, that KPI hasn't increased very much, you know, I think.
Right. So yeah, we'll definitely cover this in a new episode.
Sure.
thank you guys for listening. And we'll, you know, I know I say this every 6 months, but we're going to try to do more of these episodes. And I have a couple more lined up already. But yeah, thank you guys all for listening, and check in next time.
Thanks, Sonny.